What's good, everybody? Welcome to Origin Story, the podcast that interviews creators about where they came from to understand how they got here. My name is Philip Russell, and I am with my co-host,
Ben Thorpe.
Ben, we are back again after the episode that did absolute gangbusters with Austin Walker. And we're here with another really, really cool conversation. This time it is with Josh Sawyer of Pentiment and Fallout New Vegas. This was a really fun conversation.
Yeah, this was a blast and like a game that I was really, really excited about. I know that I've been not shutting up about it for a long time, for like a couple of months. And so, yeah, I was just really excited to have this conversation with Josh about Pentiment, a game that I really, really like. I feel like I'm increasingly becoming the meme. I don't know if you saw around Disco Elysium where it's like, oh, this gameplay is fire, and it's a photo of someone like reading a book. I just saw the other day the exact same meme, but it was Pentiment players instead of Disco Elysium players. And I'm realizing that like that is actually the exact game that I just really, really love, where it's like, hey, is it a book with like a couple of choice elements? Yes. That's my shit, baby.
You're literally like coming full circle. Like, I liked reading, and then I also like video games. Now I like reading books that have little buttons.
That's a perfect game. You got a little UX on that novel. Let's fucking go.
Yeah. So this was a really fun conversation. We talk pretty deeply about Pentiment, from how it came to be to, you know, some of the major design choices that they did for making this game really, you know, speak to the player. And I don't know about you, but yeah, I felt like I really learned a lot, not only about like the, you know, medieval time period, but also just about like game design and what makes like really good narrative design. So this is a really cool conversation.
Yeah.
So with that, how about we, you know, we'll debrief after the convo, but let's hop right in there.
Josh Sawyer is a studio design director for Obsidian Entertainment. He has worked as the director of Pentiment, Pillars of Eternity 1 and 2, and Fallout New Vegas. His most recent title, Pentiment, has won numerous awards, including the Nebula for Best Game Writing and Best Narrative, and Game of the Year at the Game Developers Choice Awards. Oh, you're shaking your head. Okay.
No. So we were nominated for all of those, but the only thing that we won was Best Narrative at GDC.
Oh, no.
Rough. Well, you should have won.
Rough start.
It's okay.
I do. Maybe the way to kick this off then is to be like, Josh, you know, obviously Pentiment, I think, has received a lot of attention and a lot of accolades. Maybe you can talk about like how you felt about the reception.
Yeah, I mean, I never have been one to really care that much about awards, to be honest. Maybe that's a result of not many of my games have been nominated for that many awards. But I made the game for personal satisfaction and also for a very niche audience, people who might not necessarily be people who play games, might not identify as gamers, people who are into history and reading and art history, which is not necessarily the core gaming audience. And I wanted people, that was who I was targeting. And so I wanted the reception among that group to be good. And it was, and I was very happy. And it was really like a lot of the awards nominations and stuff came much later. Hmm. And that's nice. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, it's nice. It's also nice. It's nice to go to London. It's nice to go to Berlin to go to award shows. But yeah, it's mostly about just, I made a game for a specific audience and for my own personal satisfaction. And it was nice to see that the people I made it for actually enjoyed it.
Yeah. One of the things that really stands out to me about Pentiment is how kind of specific and well researched it is. And can you talk about the amount of work that went into making sure the game was accurate to the time period, despite being set in, I believe, a fictional Bavarian town? You know, one of the things that we were kind of talking about before you came on is, like, the food on the table is so specific, and, like, making the choices about, like, what's at a meal, depending on, like, who you're like, breaking bread with, feels very specific. But, like, how much research went into this? It feels like it is immense.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. You know, the game is pretty light in terms of gameplay, so we could focus a lot of our attention on getting details right. I mean, my own personal belief as a director is, you know, when people say don't sweat the details, is everything is details. Every choice that you make is a specific choice. And you can make that uninformed or you can make that informed. And I always try to be as informed as possible. And now that doesn't mean that every choice I made is 100% accurate, but I made it knowing that it's inaccurate. So for example, there is a particular bit of sculpture that becomes relevant in the late game, and that's completely ahistorical. There's not a single example of a statue that looks like that. And believe me, I searched, but I needed something to work for the story, and so I made that choice. Maybe if I had done more research, I could have found something else that would have worked, but that's what I went with. So, you know, I have a degree in history, just a bachelor's degree, but it's in this time period in this region, and we worked with consultants, three PhDs, on you know, following up with a lot of things. I also did a lot of research on my own, on JSTOR, various scholarly articles. I bought academic texts that, you know, I imported from Germany to, like, you know, get super specific details on things. And then, yeah, and that extended to other people on the team as well. You know, our art director, Hannah Kennedy, she really did a ton of research into not only the art style, but also things like food and, you know, clothing, and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, obviously the manuscripts and what we included, those are all, many of them are historical. Some of them are literally facsimiles of real manuscripts, but many of them are inventions that feel like they could fit with the time and the place that they're supposed to have come from. So research was endless throughout the entire project. And yeah, that's really it.
Well, I was going to say, I find it interesting, Josh, you say, like, you kind of made this game not specifically for people who normally play games, for people who enjoy reading and academics and things like that. And, you know, Ben and I both have a academic background. I have, like, creative writing in grad school. But we also play a lot of games. And I think, like, something that was really fascinating playing through Pentiment was just the way that... you know, you kind of you blend a lot of topics and, like, experiences that I experienced, like, in academia and, like, you know, the roles of art and creation, while also making it, like, pretty approachable. But I'm curious, like, what did that look like for you as the director, and maybe just Obsidian coming to Xbox, like, trying to pitch, like, this kind of game, which, like you say, isn't really for gamers. It's maybe for a different audience.
It was actually not as hard as you might expect, because I pitched it as a small project intentionally. I said it'll probably max out at 12 people. In fact, we maxed out at 13. Oh, wow. But I said it'll be, you know, a dozen people. It'll probably be 2.5 to 3 years. In the end, it was 3 years total from pre-production to the end. And I said, it's either not going to lose money or it's going to lose a tiny amount of money and no one will care. But the most important thing I said to my boss is, I need to do this. Like, I've been waiting to make a historical game for a very long time. And I feel like this type of game would be a very good fit for Xbox Game Pass. When Microsoft acquired Obsidian, they were really pushing Game Pass and they wanted to have unique titles that were available on that platform. And yeah, they went for it. You know, when I had already been working on it with my team of about 5 people for 9 months in pre-production before we really showed it to Xbox, and they loved it. Because it was very distinctive. I feel like I had a pretty clear vision. Even the prototype is not that much different from the end game in terms of overall style and approach. And yeah, they could feel that. It felt very specific. It felt very much like it had a particular artistic vision that was unique. And so they thought it would be great for Game Pass. And so after that point, you know, there would briefly be conversations of, like, oh man, you know, all this reading without VO is going to turn people off. And I said, okay, like it's okay. Like if you don't like reading, don't play the game. If you don't like sports, don't play NBA 2K. Like, what do you want me to say? It's just like, it's interesting because there a common refrain in reviews that are even ones that really praise the game a lot have this caveat that says, you know, this isn't for everyone. No shit. Like not, no game is for everyone. It's just that the narrative about games is that there's kind of the gamer audience, the mainstream gamer audience, and that games that are made for them are for everyone. When in fact they exclude a lot of people who just fundamentally aren't interested in those sort of experiences. So, you know, I said, no, this game, yes, it is not for everyone. It's for these specific people. And I think we can find that audience. I think some of them do play games, to your point. It's not completely for non-gamers, but also I have seen that there are people who either don't play many games or don't play games at all who have come to it because it's very approachable. It's not mechanically complicated. It's really about reading and making choices and following along with the story. And then the mini games are very simple. They're not made for challenge. They're made for immersion and to break up the pacing. So yeah, it was actually not difficult to convince the people above me or around me to kind of buy into the concept of the game.
So you were mentioning that you've wanted to do something for like this for a long time. I read a Game Informer piece that was saying you had an idea for this back in like 1992. I mean, maybe you can talk about like how long has this been gestating and like what has that looked like over the years?
Yeah, I would say, well, in 1992, I played a game called Darklands that was made by Microprose Labs. And it's a very unique role-playing game. I actually did a Let's Play of it, like Twitch stream. I played the whole game. And I think there are fragments of it still up on YouTube. But it was very interesting to me because it was very unlike any other RPG I had played because it was historical fantasy. So they didn't have classes or wizards or alignment or levels. The mechanics were very unique. The way that magic was conceived of as being through intercession of saints or alchemy was very unique. And when I got into the industry in 1999, I knew that I really wanted to work on a Fallout game. I went to work for Black Isle Studios. I really wanted to work on D&D games, which they were making currently. And then I really had this desire in my mind. I'm like, I love Darklands so much. I really hope I get to make a historical role-playing game sometime. And in my mind, that game looked like Darklands for a long time. Some form of that, like small party-based thing where you're wandering around, whether it's, you know, early modern Holy Roman Empire or Italy or France or whatever. But that was kind of the vague vision. But I knew I wanted to do something historical. And it only was in the last, you know, like 5 years or so that I started having more of a vision. I played Night in the Woods, which is a really fantastic game. Yep. And I would say more than any other game, Night in the Woods was the biggest inspiration for the overall style of what Pentiment is, where you're a guy walking around town talking to everyone in this community over a long period of time, and just kind of vibing with them and doing little mini games. That's really what both games are. There's just more choice and consequence and light RPG stuff in Pentiment. But when I saw that, I thought, oh, I could make a story that's historical and it's really about this specific person going through a specific thing. And this could be the style of game. But I also didn't really know how I would get it made. And it was kind of floating around after I shipped Deadfire. I was pretty burned out because Deadfire sold very poorly. It reviewed very well, but it sold very poorly. And I was really burned out about it. Over time, it actually sold quite well, and it is very profitable now, thankfully. It just took several years. But while I was burned out, I had this kind of idea for this game, but I was also like, how am I going to get this made? Because we're still an independent developer. I don't know if I want to go back to crowdfunding because I don't want to compromise on what the game is. And when Microsoft acquired us, I went to Fergus and I said, look, I really want to do this. I'm not busy right now. I'm just helping out on other projects. I can't do a big project because we have these other things going on. So just let me have a small group of people to make this. And he was very supportive from the beginning.
Huh. Why, just out of curiosity, like with Pentiment specifically, why a video game? Like what was it maybe about this kind of thing that you wanted to work, this project you wanted to work on that you've, you know, it's been gestating for decades. What was it about like the medium of video games that really drew you to wanting to do it?
I mean, I guess in a way, all the RPGs that I believe, like almost all the RPGs anyway that I've worked on, really emphasize the player's involvement in the story and make, in the sense that they're an active participant. They can make choices that change how the story develops. They can choose how their relationships go. They can blow up their relationships or, you know, like try to cement them, you know, like patch them back up. And you can do that in a collaborative storytelling environment, certainly, like tabletop role-playing games are where I came from. But video games also, because they are interactive, offer something that film doesn't and that most books that are not choose your own adventure books don't do. So it was also because it's a combined, you know, like it's a visual medium as well. And so being able to express things through the art itself and the aesthetic actually having meaning within the story was very important to me. So all these things, and also it's the medium that I work in. So, you know, like all those things sort of combined to make an environment where I felt like the experience was most well suited for a game on a computer or a console.
Yeah, one of the things that stands out to me about Pentiment is the way that choice works. You know, this game feels to me like it's giving players like these really nuanced choices where, you know, often in games it feels like things are very binary. You have a very clear picture of like, here's what's right, here's what's wrong. And often Pentiment is like, hey, pick a person that you think did this murder. And you're like, I'm pretty sure I don't know the correct answer here. I'm pretty sure I chose wrong. And you just have to sit with that. And there's no point where the game is like, oh, you made the right choice, or this is like what you should have done. And even, you know, that's the macro, but even down to the micro, when you start getting into those dialogue choices, I often felt like I was like, I don't know the right, you know, there's no correct choice here in terms of how to engage with someone. And maybe you can just talk about like, it felt so much more realistic and so much more human. And how did that work in terms of implementing something like that?
So there's a number of layers there. So one of it is that, yes, it was a goal that the player should feel uncomfortable and uncertain about the decisions that they make, and that, but they shouldn't feel necessarily complete frustration or hopelessness, more that they're in, you know, sort of the Greek agony situation where they're like, well, I have two bad decisions that I can pick from. Like, I'm not going to be super stoked about either of these. But like I kind of have to decide something because the consequences of not deciding are worse. You know, like it's established that Piero is my buddy. It's established that there's literally no way that he could have even physically done it, even if he had the motive, which it's very unlikely that he did. So I know I don't want this guy to die, but then someone else is going to die. Among these up to four other people, or five, I guess potentially, who. And it kind of comes down to a realization like you have within the ideal city in your dream where, you know, Beatrice or Beatrice says to you, you know, you don't actually have to give all the information that you know. And she sort of implies like you can just pick someone that you think should not live for whatever, you know, whatever your sort of criteria for that are, which is really grim, but it's also to let the player know, like, this is how this is going to go. You're going to name someone and they're going to die. And you kind of have to support it, but that's going to happen. And I wanted players to be uncomfortable with that because I think it makes people think more about their values and why they make the decisions that they do, and also understand the difficult position that they are in. And then when it came to the individual conversations, the way that we handle dialogue checks and this will be remembered and all of that stuff, in a way it's intentionally scattershot because it needs to be dense enough for the player to, it can't be constant because you can't make, it's just unworkable. But it has to be frequent enough and unheralded so that the player understands this node might be a node where the thing that I say is going to be remembered. So I have to, in a sort of panopticon way, I have to believe that I'm constantly being observed and I'm constantly being monitored for the things that I say, and that the nature of your relationship to the person to whom you're speaking is relevant and important. So for example, being kind of defiant and standing up to someone who doesn't have any authority is probably not going to bite you in the ass because that person has no authority. When you do that to the abbot, like it means something. When you do that to the archdeacon, Jakob Estler, he very quickly makes it clear this is his his court essentially, and you're a guest in it. And if you lip off, it's going to have bad consequences. So it puts a player in a situation where, no, you can role play the way that you want, but possibly the way that you want is going to be shaped by the understanding that there's a power dynamic here that you can't overcome. So maybe you should just shut up. Or maybe you should be diplomatic, or like maybe you can say something here, but you're going to have to make up for it somewhere else. And the goal there really was to get players to engage in the moment-to-moment choices that they make in conversations, and not just treat them all as filler between the plot points. When you talk to Illuminata, there are a lot of mines. There are a lot of like mines planted in the dialogue with Illuminata, where if you're irreverent, or you're kind of like condescending about women, she'll tell you like that's messed up, and you'll see she's remembering it, and you go like, oh shit, like I can't just say whatever. Like this actually is impactful. And the goal was really to make that perfuse all the dialogues to the extent that the player cared about what they were saying moment to moment, even if it was not always dramatically consequential.
Yeah, it worked really well, and I feel like I at the beginning of the year I transitioned into working in games and narrative and like been learning narrative design and things like that. And I found Pentiment to be really fascinating in terms of how you all designed the different dialogue choices, because I found myself, because of the, I don't even know how to describe it, like that this will be remembered kind of idea. I found myself being more affected by that than I normally would be in other games. Like I felt like myself being a lot more politically motivated in terms of how I was engaging with the different characters and kind of my relationship to them. And I especially was interested in, there's moments where you're talking to a character and then you'll get like your dialogue choices, but then also like a thought bubble where you kind of have this interior moment where you're working through some ideas. So like one instance for the listeners is like thinking about the plight of women during the 16th century and whether or not they actually have it hard. And and it was like this really delightful moment, I think, because it sheds light on Andres as a character, but also you as a player. I'm curious, like, I don't even know what the question is there. I'm just really interested in how you all kind of came to that kind of design with the narrative.
Yeah, I think it's thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's in a way it's kind of ripping off ideas from other games. So we've always at Obsidian and Black Isle, we believe choice and consequence, great. A lot of times players make choices blindly, or those it's a low frequency, high impact choice. And so when it suddenly happens, they're really kind of taken aback and maybe even feel cheated because they weren't expecting it to matter suddenly. And then, the Telltale games would use, this, they'll remember this, this character will remember this. And that phrasing was very specific. And so we turned it a little bit. Instead of saying this character will remember it, we said this thing will be remembered. How? By whom? In some cases, a thing that is remembered by multiple people, or it's remembered by a person who is not the person to whom you spoke, but observed the interaction. That happens with Brother Woslav. So like, if you sass off to the abbot, he actually notes that. The abbot also notes it, but when you talk to Woslav about talking to Piero in the cellar, he's responding to the interaction that you had with the abbot in the dinner and also in the murder scene. So we made it more abstract to put the player a little more on edge. And then the other thing was we put the thought bubbles in there, and there's an intentional delay of about half a second, I think. So if you're just like, nope, I'm confident, like I'm picking that, you won't see the thought bubble because you as a player are, you're just going. So if you wait a second, if you as the player are waiting a moment and you're reading the options, then the bubble appears. And that's your cue to be like, oh, I think maybe this is consequential in a way that other things might not be, or it might not immediately be apparent. So then you go into your interior monologue, or not monologue, because it's really a conversation with the three, they're essentially id, ego, super ego of Andreas's conscience. So you talk to Beatrice, you talk to Socrates and you talk to St. Grobian, and they each represent sort of a different facet of understanding or processing what's at hand. And in the end, it always kind of suggests one way or another, either positively or negatively, this is kind of probably the wisest thing to do. But you can ignore it. It just then when you exit, it just resets you to where you were. So another example is the when Otto tells you to say hello to Clara for him, and it's very clear that Otto and or not Clara, Ava. So Otto and Ava are a couple that is kind of on a certain course, and you can be a rascal and flirt with Ava. And you can have a moment where you think to yourself about that, and Beatrice is like, do not do that. That's very bad and dumb. Like, nothing good is going to come from it. It's insulting and it's just going to aggravate people. And Socrates says something that's very idealistic and high-minded and not helpful. And it's very clear that it's not helpful. And then Grobian says something very base and ridiculous. And on its face, you're like, well, that's clearly not, like, that's just kind of dumb and silly. And so, really, if you choose to flirt with her, then Otto does actually get mad at you, and he holds it over your head all through Act Two as well. But the player might not know that, and so in the moment they might just be like, "I'm just going to say something." So we have that moment where we're like, "Hold on!" Like, if you're actually thinking about this as a player, Andreas is also thinking about it as a character. Why don't you think through the consequences before you say something, and then you can make a choice. And the player can still make the rascal choice, and it doesn't break the game or anything. They just when they talk to Otto, when you go to the final day of judgment at the end of Act One, he's pretty cold to you. He kind of is like, don't let the door hit your ass on the way out. and then in Act Two, he hasn't forgotten it. He's like, hey, I remember what you tried to steal away my girl, so don't get any ideas. But the player can do it. So it was a way of, and then also really like those micro choices as opposed to the big choices, they were really, the idea was just from Disco Elysium. So Disco Elysium would use minor interactions to influence the mechanic, the mathematics of the checks. But I don't think that they telegraphed them when you made them, only when you made the check. So we combined the messaging of you just made a choice that's going to be remembered. And then when you make the check, it's listed as, hey, remember when you did that? Here it is in this check. And you go, oh, yeah, that's right. I did. I flirted with Otto's girlfriend. I guess I should have expected that. So, some people were still sort of bewildered or off put by the system, but I think for the most part, it did what I wanted it to do.
The thing that, like, for me really, really I works about it is that I would say upfront I'm like a pretty bad gamer where it's like a game offers me like choices and I'm immediately going to be like, well, what's the correct choice? I'll just Google it and figure it out so I make sure that I'm just on the right path to save myself some time so I can get
Sure.
the best ending. And I think that your game thwarts that in a way that is like great and beautiful, where it's like because the options are more nuanced and because the consequences never feel like they're cataclysmic, I'm like, oh, I'm willing to make some of these mistakes and just like ride it out because that's just how it works and that's how
Yeah.
life works. And it really felt like it kind of, as you were saying, made me much more reflective of myself, where I was like, what's the political choice that I'm making here? Why am I making this decision? Why am I choosing not to throw the stonemason name into the hat? I actually kind of like that guy. And you know what? A lot of these brothers, I'm not vibing with them. So I'm
Yep.
gonna get more dirt on them. And then I was like, well, why am I, it's a great game where it's like, I think like it makes you reflect on your own politics in a lot of ways, as much as it does be like, okay, well, but like, what's the correct way to move through it?
Yeah, and I think the thing is, it's a very common sentiment where, the more a suspect see the less likable a suspect is, the easier it is for people to condemn them. The more likable a suspect is, the harder it is, even when in the tally, people tend to believe that the most likable person is probably the person who did it. And again, there's no object. I've even said like, if you at there is not a canonical killer. Nowhere have I ever defined that. But I have said that objectively, like when I look at the evidence, there are people where I'm like, it seems more likely that this person did it. It seems less likely this other person did it. You can never get all the information on one playthrough. It's impossible. It's structured so that you can't know everything. But even so, there are people who get evidence where it seems likely that a person did it. But they're like, I don't want that person to suffer. Like, I feel like they were justified in doing what they did. I like them. I don't like the person who died, and I don't like this guy. So they're going to be the one that pays. And I mean, if you look at the Steam achievements, there's a pretty clear tendency of who gets accused. And yeah, it is all about saying, like, you know, what do you really value? Knowing that this is inescapable, knowing that one of these people is definitely going to die, and it's the person, it's one of the people that you name. By the way, there is an internal logic, so you can also kind of just do like a Yahtzee thing. Like, you can kind of go in and say, here's all the information I know about everybody, but I don't know. And there is a mechanic to that. There is like a logic to it. And so some people do that, but the majority of people that I've seen play, they just name one person, or they just name two people. They almost everyone excludes someone. They just say, like, I don't know. I never heard anything about Matilda, never heard anything about Lucky. Don't know, don't know. So yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that. But yeah, I was very intentional to set up that feeling where the player was just accepting that there isn't an ideal outcome here. There's not a way where things just turn out fantastic. There are slightly worse or slightly better outcomes, but even sometimes the things that in the short term seem good can have bad consequences. I mean, one of the things that happens with if you save Attilia's the widow, if you save her home, or rather keep her in her home, it creates other conflicts in the future for other people. So, you know, on its face, it's clearly like a very nice and sweet thing to do for someone that no one in the town likes, but there are other consequences for that that you couldn't have predicted. But that's just how things go. You know, sometimes you do things and it seems like the right thing, and at the time it seemed like it, but you can't control the future. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted it to be in one community over a long period of time, so that, you know, 25 years is long enough that generations are starting to pass, and the seeds that you planted in 1518 are growing into full-blown trees in 1543.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like the game just from the outset, it does a really good job of kind of throwing a bunch of what seemingly are kind of innocuous choices and dialogue that ultimately end up kind of blowing up in your face. You know, like from the get-go, when you can you when you're asked to get your next month's salary so you can help pay the additional taxes, and you know, that's like one of the first choices you make in the game. And when I was playing through, I was kind of like, yeah, I can help you with that. It seems like that's something Andreas would do. And then, you know, 30 minutes later, you're thrust into all these different conversations where you're kind of forced to have these uncomfortable conversations with your bosses, essentially, of like, hey, can I get some money? I found that to be like really fascinating. And I think, yeah, like everything you're talking about with the this will be remembered kind of idea, it works so well in terms of getting the player into like thinking about the character they're building. Like something that I was talking to Ben about off air was I just really loved that moment early on where you are eating lunch with your boys outside, and there's just this moment where you get to choose which food to eat. Like there's like a bread slice, some cheese, and like a pastry or something, and I don't know if that ends up mattering, but I just loved that. It felt like really delightful as a from a narrative design and just like a play perspective of like here's a moment that doesn't you know plant a flagpole of like this is going to be an important choice, but it's something that for the player suggests the character that you're building, and I felt like that was like a really awesome and like unique kind of way of kind of adding in some maybe interactive elements to the game.
Thank you. The meals were very important, not so much from the order in which you eat things or, you know, what you eat when, but more for communicating social status and class, which becomes more apparent the longer time goes on. But in a way, it's also to kind of making it so front and center. One, it steps you out of the normal game view. So much of the game is just walking around and talking to people that it was very important that we had other modes of interacting with the world that were just different and sort of force you to look at things through a different lens. And at a certain point, the meals became about the tables and the food and the specific food and how we laid it out, not even just the food, what it is served in, how you are eating it. Like when you eat a meal in the first act with the Gertners, the family you're staying with, the Gertners are peasants and they are not wealthy, and it's a fairly large family. And so their food is not fantastic, but it's not like awful. Later in the act, you can eat with Lady Salamea, who is Lawrence Rotvogel's wife. And I don't know if either of you did that meal, but she's just come from Venice and she's a noble woman. You are drinking wine out of crystal. She has candied oranges, like, and you don't even finish all the food. Like, you finish the meal and there's still half the things that were on the table are still there and the meal is done. So there's a very strong contrast between this is how nobles eat, literally bringing things from another country over the Alps to eat with them as they travel, versus the peasantry where they're like, we got stew, we have bread, like that's basically what we got. And we get by on it and, you know, whatever, but there's a big difference there. And then in Act Two, when you eat with the Gertners again, there's a really strong marked decline in the quality of and the quantity of what they're eating. And that's very intentional. So it's not about necessarily the order of anything, but it is forcing you to really focus on the material reality that these people live in and how different it is between the peasantry, the, you know, growing middle class, and then the nobility itself.
If you're comfortable with it, I want to ask you a little bit about like what the game says or has to say about like art writ large and like art's ability to like preserve history. I was so struck. So, you know, in the third act, we move not from kind of trying to make decisions about murders, but we're trying to make decisions about murals. And we're trying to make decisions about, like, what's the story that we're telling about this place? And the big reveal of the third act comes after we've already made the decisions about the murals that are going to go up. And that, to me, felt so important to the kind of the final thing that the game felt like it was trying to say about art, which is that, like, our understanding of not just the past, but even the present is imperfect. And so that, like, our representations are always going to be put together in a way that's falling short of reality. And I don't, maybe you can just speak to like that, because it felt like it was resonating through every act where it's like, as a person making decisions about the world, you're always moving forward with imperfect, incomplete ways of knowing that world.
Yeah, it was very intentional, of course. If it were unintentional, I just miraculously stumbled into it. But I mean, it comes up in the very first conversation that Piero and Andreas have in the scriptorium, where Andreas is working on his masterpiece. And, you know, Piero says, you know, this is very well executed, but it's just copying another work. Like, you're copying the Indermauer manuscript, and which, to be clear, is fictional, but it could have existed. And because that's the thing, is like that illustration looks like countless other illustrations from that time period. Very well executed, but essentially telling the same story. In November, we show peasants foraging, you know, with pigs, foraging acorns in the forest. That's what we do for November. That's the way it's done. And art, and the thing is, there's a little bit of anachronism here, because our modern conceptions of art and expression are not the concepts of how, yeah. Piero is like a very forward-thinking guy, because he's saying like, this is a personal choice that you're making. Like, you are choosing to replicate. You are choosing to not critically look at what you're portraying compared to the reality of life around you. And, you know, when he says like, you know, we can't avoid put ourselves into this, either there's an unconscious bias or an implicit acceptance of the status quo, or there is a conscious rejection of that to say, no, this isn't actually the world anymore. The world is now this way. And, you know, Piero's happiness with Andreas at the end is to say, you changed it. It's the image before where it was, it's the Gertners, by the way. Like, I don't know if people look very closely, but it is actually the Gertners that are in the image that he paints. But it's not them with the pigs in the forest. It's them with the pigs and a fence between the forest and their land, because they're not allowed in there. And so Piero says, you are actually showing the world as it is now. And you have put yourself into it. And Andreas, again, I don't know if people notice, but he is in the Advent procession at the bottom of the scene. So he took it both literally and figuratively. but we're always making choices. Like, we make choices about the stories that we tell, how we frame the stories that we tell, the aesthetics of people. I mean, not to get too lost in the weeds here, but like, excuse me, Brecht, like one of the, you know, alienation effect is something that Brecht was really into, which is to say, you know, it's so easy for us to have the moral good be embodied in the aesthetically ideal or the aesthetically appealing. And so he would work to make his moral messengers these like really repulsive or unlikable characters, because his belief was if this is truth, then the messenger of truth can be unpleasant and the truth will still shine through. But the point is, whether Brecht was right or not, is that we do make choices about all these things, the story, the places, how they're framed, the characters that embody certain ideas and how they express them. And when you tell history, you are again making choices. The tragically late Hilary Mantel, God, I'm going to mangle the thing that she said, but history isn't a record of the past. History is what we have left of the things that people in the past chose to write down. And we have one, it's through their perspective and what they chose to do, and we have so little of it. I mean, one of the big inspirations that, you know, I think a lot of people have pointed to was Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, which is in itself about a lost book from antiquity. So much of antiquity is gone. Like, we have glimpses and ideas of the works of Ovid or, you know, Aristophanes, but then if you look at the plays of Aristophanes that we actually have, it's like a tenth of what he wrote. So then extend that to history and historical records, it's the same thing. So we have such a fragile grasp on the past, and it is through the lens of people that made a very specific set of decisions in a time and place, and by luck, they have been preserved and passed on to us now. So it's really conveying the role of the individual recorder, whether it's of history or art or history through art, in that process as an active agent.
You know, something that I really appreciated, again, from the early parts of the game, and as a Black player and creator, is, you know, you have this moment with Brother Sabbat, I think that's how you say his name, who is an Ethiopian priest who's visiting the abbey. And you have this moment where he kind of is telling Andreas that he's been invited over for dinner from somebody in the town, and they're one of the few people who kind of, you know, don't make him feel uncomfortable for being unlike everyone else, and that he'd feel even more comfortable if Andreas would come with him. I was really taken aback by seeing the character in the game, in this game, given that it's, you know, a medieval 16th century story. And I was just curious because, you know, there's so many examples lately, especially in games, like not to scapegoat one, but just as an example, Final Fantasy 16 has kind of come under a lot of criticism because it's, although it's a fantasy game, it's, you know, devoid of people of color, and the reasoning being that it's like a kind of a medieval inspired game, and there weren't Black people that existed in the medieval times. You know, it felt like having Brother Sabbat in the game was a deliberate choice that kind of is engaging with what you're talking about of choices being made and how we depict history. And I'd love if you could just talk a little bit about like how maybe that character came into the game.
Sure. Yeah, there were two very, actually there were more than a few, but yeah, there were Black people in Europe, you know, and there weren't a lot of them, but I guess the thing is, you know, Tassing and Kearsarge are fictional in the same way that the Abbey and Name of the Rose is fictional. It is plausible, but it is a specific confluence of some fictional and some real people around a real idea in a real time and place. To create a fiction. Like, all of this is fiction, but, you know, by saying that Tassing is a fictional place and Kearsarge is a fictional place, I can populate that with whoever I want. And unless there's some strict contradiction about a real person, you know, there are millions of people that lived and died of whom there are no records anymore, so I can just make people up. And the thing is, you know, Brother Sephod even says, if you talk to him, that he is repaying a favor that was done to one of his predecessors 100 years ago at the Council of Constance. There are records that there were members of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church at the Council of Constance in the 15th century, and Constance is even more remote than Tassing, like on the Via Imperii. So, you know, I said it is plausible that an agent of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church comes to give this gift. And the idea was that, you know, I think it's Abbot Rudolph 100 years ago gave his bishop a Catholic Bible. And, you know, that was very beautiful. And so it took 100 years to give him back an Ethiopian manuscript. And it was just because the thing is, there's one I find African history and Ethiopian history specifically very interesting and fascinating. A lot of people don't know that Ethiopia was, I think, like the second Christian nation in the world after, like, I think Armenia. Mm-hmm. And it has a very strong manuscript tradition that's very distinct and beautiful. And it's just very interesting. And their relationship with Europe during this period was also very interesting because they were under attack by Muslim nations, and they appealed to their fellow Christians in Europe to help them. And so there was this, you know, they're more present, again, in very small numbers in places like Italy or in Portugal. That was, I think, where a lot of the traffic came, Portuguese coming to Ethiopia and a few vice versa. But anyway, it's just, yes, they existed. They have their own traditions. It's rich and beautiful. And I'm telling the story here. So in this story, Brother Sephod is here, and you're going to go on a journey through an Orthodox Ethiopian Bible. Enjoy. And there were other things, too, that I thought was interesting is that, you know, it's, I didn't want to portray something that felt absurd. Like, certainly white people living in the Alps seeing an Ethiopian would be, if nothing else, just surprised. I mean, like, wow, like, yeah. I've never maybe even heard of people that look like you. That's crazy. And the other thing that's interesting is I read Kate Lowe, who is a historian dealing with Ethiopian contact with Europe, said that Ethiopian priests in Europe would wear their Orthodox clothes. So they would not adopt local fashion. So someone like Sephod not only has different skin tone, different hair, different features, but he's also wearing very different clothing, like that just looks very shocking to people. So I didn't want to portray it as something where everyone was like not phased at all by him being there, but also the ideas that we have about race didn't really exist in the same way then. And of course there would be bias or suspicion or maybe wonder that was unwarranted, but it's the alien, like it's just, we don't know. And that's the conversation that Sephod has with the little girl, Anna. He's like, yeah, there are people that look way different all over the world. It's crazy. I found a historical tidbit, which was Albrecht Dürer kept personal diaries, and he's one of the only artists of this period where we actually have records of his travel journals. And he traveled to somewhere in the Netherlands, and he saw gold art that had been brought back from, I want to say, I can't remember if it was Incan or Aztec, but it was gold art from the New World. And he said, this is the most beautiful art I have ever seen. It eclipses anything made by European Christians.
Hmm.
Like, he had no reservation just saying, this is incredible. It's unreal. I love it. And so the sort of biases that I think that people, you know, centuries of time have, you know, like created all of this weirdness about race and culture and those interactions. And in a lot of cases, there really was just genuine wonder. I mean, don't get me wrong. There was obviously exploitation and horrible colonialism going on. But the fact remains that an ordinary person who saw someone from another culture with clothing they'd never seen, food they'd never seen, art they had never seen, would often just be awed. Like, they were just like, wow, like, that is crazy. Like, in a good way. So I did want to really convey that, one, they were there. Two, the relationships weren't necessarily what we thought they were. And that it's just interesting to illuminate that stuff and have an unlikely circumstance be educational. There's one other detail there, which is the church or the chapel where that takes place with St. Moritz is that from about the 13th century through, I think, the 17th or 18th century, St. Moritz was consistently portrayed as a Black Northern African man, as a knight. He's found in tons of artwork. He's found in sculptures. He's always clearly, unambiguously, not just Black, but like an African, like they understood different style of hair or facial features. And he was one of the most popular saints. He was the patron saint of the Holy Roman Empire. Very popular and Black. And yes, eventually race became a thing, and that, oh, hey, we're practicing slavery now. We gotta, he's a white guy now. But you know, these things shift and they change, but it's important to understand that at this time and place, it's not necessarily the way that we thought it was. So I wanted to really portray that as well as I could.
Can I kind of get you to talk about like the state of, or like the landscape for games like this? You know, selfishly, like, I really love Disco Elysium. I really love Night in the Woods. I really love Pentiment. Last year's Citizen Sleeper, you know, these kinds of games that are like, you know, I can really get invested in and engage with, and then end and feel like I've, you know, in some ways, like I'm stepping away from a novel. What does it take to get these made? And is there, you know, are we in a good moment for them, or like, where are we?
You know, it's weird because on the one hand, I appreciate being compared to a bunch of other games that I think are really incredible. The thing is, all those games were made under material conditions that are way more challenging than what I made them under. You know, the Disco Elysium story is like kind of well known, although they did eventually get quite a bit of funding, but the way they started was very sort of ragtag. We don't know what we're doing. Let's just see what we can do. And I'm not to downplay what, you know, like what their sort of journey was. But then like Night in the Woods was also made by a very small team. And, you know, I've talked a lot with Scott Benson. I consider him a good friend now, and we've talked a lot about his game and my game and kind of like where we see things going. And I know that Scott really struggled and his team really struggled to get that game done, and it really took a big toll on him, like health-wise. And then, yeah, I don't know a whole lot about the circumstances, let's say, of Citizen Sleeper, but I know it's, again, it's like not necessarily a solo dev, but a very small team. And I work at a huge company and, you know, like I work at a big developer. You know, we have well over 200 devs here. We're part of Xbox, which is huge. And I kind of, through the privilege of being here a long time and being canny, just said, I want to make this right now. All the other people made things under much more difficult circumstances than I did. So that's worth saying, because the way I got it done is not the way that other people necessarily can get it done. That being said, I do think that there's a challenge in that so many games are being made. It's, I can't, like, just go look at Steam. There are so many games. I can't remember how many more times. It's like five times as many games came out in 2022 versus like 2 years ago or something. Wow. It's wild. Like, it's really exploding. And that's, on the one hand, that's good, because so many small teams or even solo devs have the ability to make really unique experiences. And some of them are very unique and not fun, and they're not meant to be fun, or they can just flop, and that's okay. And it's even okay with the person that made them, because maybe they made them because they just wanted to express something, and they don't give a shit if people like it or not, or if it makes any money. They just wanted to make a thing. That's very artistic, and that's very respectable, I think, and valid. But the challenge is that there are so many games, it's hard to get attention and hard to get noticed. I do think that digital distribution and all these platforms do make it easier for individual people or small groups of people to make games that are really visionary games, where they have a specific point of view that they're trying to communicate, a specific style, specific mechanics. That's way more possible than it was like 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it wasn't even, I would say, barely possible to do that. You'd have to be independently wealthy or get the blessing of a publisher who wanted to lose money. But yeah, like the fact that we're talking about all of these games, and other than Pentiment, the other ones were at least started under very modest circumstances where people just said, I want to make a game. I think that's good, and it's very promising. And you know, I am very fortunate that I got to make Pentiment, but also in a lot of ways, I'm very jaded because I've been doing this for almost 24 years now, actually 24 years now. And there's a certain tunnel vision that comes along with that, ways of doing things or not doing things, natural conservatism that just comes with age and experience, some of that is good and some of it is very limiting. So I'm glad that the floor has gone way down in terms of access, so that more younger people who, you know, the anecdote that I always like to give is Citizen Kane. Orson Welles was very frank about, he said, the way I made Citizen Kane is that I didn't know what couldn't be done. He was like 28 years old, which is incredible. And he was like, I want to do this. And people said, we don't do that. And he's like, yeah, but what if we could? Like, what if we could do that? And then the people around him had the experience to go like, yeah, we could try that. But he fully admits that he basically just stumbled through it because he had a very clear vision of what he wanted to do with none of the conservative preconceptions that they couldn't be done. And some people are going to try to do that and they're going to burn out, and that's unfortunate, or they'll just fail. You know, they'll try to do something and it won't work out. But there are so many young developers that are doing truly, really groundbreaking, creative things, and there's a lot of them. And some of those things will sort of inspire other people, and some won't, and that's okay. But it's more possible now than it ever was before. The only bummer about the whole thing is the financial situation behind it, which is, it's just hard to get people to play your game and give you the money to keep going. Even games that are very successful or very sort of like good don't necessarily find the audience to recoup cost and keep someone going. Or if they get there, the person making it, it takes such a emotional or personal toll that they just burn out and they can't keep moving forward. And that's a huge bummer.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, even at like at the top of the show, when you were talking about how Pentiment, you were able to kind of pitch it as this low cost, you know, small team project, and it got greenlit. You know, I feel like there's been a number of developers that we've had on, like Xavier Nelson Jr. and you know, somebody else, I'm not thinking of right now, but basically they were talking about how hard it is as an indie developer to do just that, of like pitching the smaller cost, small team game, because so many publishers are always chasing like these big returns. So yeah, it just seems like we're in a really, really like, it's easier than ever to make games, for like anybody can make a game, but at the same time it seems like the cost of making games is really becoming restrictive in a lot of senses.
It's rough too, and a lot of it comes down to cost of living, like, you know, it's I remember seeing something really weird, because I worked on two crowdfunded games, and I'm very appreciative because we found an audience that publishers told us either didn't exist or wasn't worth pursuing because it was too small, as you sort of suggested. But you know, something in the early days of crowdfunding, I remember this kind of meme going around, which someone said, wait, are we paying for the game or are we paying for your living expenses? And it's like, duh, what do you think a salary is for? Like, yeah, you're paying for me to work on the game so that I can live. Like, I'm going to buy food so that I live. I'm going to pay for my rent so I don't die. And then in my house with food, I will then type and make a game. So it's this weird, like yes, people have to live, and it's more expensive to live, and it's so it's harder to, you know, do this on the side, or especially full time. That's the real challenge. So yeah, you're right, like the tools are there, we can work remotely, you can find people around the world to work with. I mean, one of the games that I really enjoyed from, I guess, four or five years ago now, Mordhau, was made by I think seven devs all working remotely in different countries. And they just did it, which is crazy. And they were all like, I don't think any of them had professional dev experience. They just made that game, which is wild. So it's more possible, but the challenges are not trivial. And a lot of them just have to do with the realities of the marketplace and capitalism.
I think we're winding down here. I don't know. Do you have a hard out at 6 o'clock?
I do.
Or 3 o'clock. Oh, okay. Well then, maybe I'll just say thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, this was really fun.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Obviously, really loved Pentiment. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was our conversation with Josh Sawyer.
Nailed it. You got it. You got it in one.
We were joking off air that neither of us can say Josh's name like when we actually need to. So there it was again, messed it up. But
that S and that H, they are placed in a way designed to make the mouth fuck up. It's not our fault.
I laughed because like when I was saying it, like when I'm really thinking about saying Josh Sawyer, I can feel my mouth like moving in the way that Trump like will say, like enunciate words in certain ways.
Josh Sawyer.
Yeah. I can like imagine my hands doing his little Trumpism. But anyway, this was a really fun conversation. You know, Ben, you similar to when we were trying to do Citizen Sleeper and there's another game. I can't think of it now, but you know, these kind of more text-based adventure game kind
of
things.
Do I need to apologize to you? I'm a fucking menace. I really just am like, I'm like, hey, I'm just going to make you read this game.
Yeah. Play another book, you know.
Hey, you got time?
But, you know, similar to Citizen Sleeper, I will commend you in saying that Pentiment, really, really cool game. I think even more so, I'll commend you because, you know, medieval European lit really doesn't hit for me normally.
Fair.
It's a really, really cool game. So it was fun talking to Josh about, you know, how it came to be. And I think for me, just like, that portion of the conversation about this will be remembered, that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, I also feel like the, you know, like if I'm explaining like the psychosis of me and like why games like this continue to hit, I think there's a part of me that can't ever like truly just like go full piece of shit mode and just like allow myself to just be entertained. There has to be like an element of like work to it, or feel like there's an element of like, you know, oh, I'm getting something, or I'm like learning something or whatever. And I think these kinds of games do a great job of like, and this Pentiment in particular, where it feels like, is this almost educational? Like, am I right on the like the razor's edge of, am I playing just like an educational game? One of the things that I loved about this is if you're not following just the main plot beats, you can go into people's houses and just start having conversations where they'll explain to you, like, here's what the world is like at this time, or like, here's some like dynamic that's going on in the world at this point, or here's how people at this point in time are thinking about the church or religion. And those conversations were just like pretty cool to have, where it was like, oh, you can just like go get different perspectives from the town on how they're seeing the mechanics of class, or how they're seeing, you know, the world as it's put together. And I think that like allows a little like broken part of my brain that's always like, oh, you should be working more, to turn off and just like let me like play a game in a way that like works.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of like tricking the player into learning kind of idea, I think, yeah, this game to me, more successfully than necessarily like, you know how Assassin's Creed has like a mode where you can kind of learn about like ancient Egypt or whatever. If you play like the Egyptian Assassin's Creed Origins, like there's like a whole mode dedicated to it. I almost liked how with Pentiment, although it's like a fictional town, it definitely does a really good job of just baking into the experience the fact that you're learning so much about you know, the people, the culture, kind of like the time period. And, you know, Josh's point about like the innocuous choices, like choosing which foods to eat, how like, you know, those are important to include into the game, not only because it's like gives a little bit of interactivity to the game, but also it suggests things about class. I find that to be like a really smart way of implementing like these commentaries without necessarily like drawing a huge, you know, magnifying glass onto like, here's the themes, you know, which like a lot of other games can fall victim to.
Yeah. And I think the thing that, you know, and you brought this up a bunch and I've been thinking about it, is the way that it it isn't slapping you over the head with a lot of the stuff that it's doing. And it does that because you're just having kind of casual conversations with people in the town. And those feel really lived in. Like, they feel like conversations that you could be having with someone down the street. And so I just really loved going back to those where it's like, oh, hey, where's your life at right now? How are things going? Oh, you're having trouble because, you know, oh, the church is, you know, increasing taxes and now you're having trouble putting food on the table. And, you know, and so you're having this like heady conversation and then someone's like, you know, making jokes or quipping. And it's like, it just feels really real. And I think we talked about this before where it's like, you know, even a game like Disco to some extent, which I, again, really loved, is so stylized that it doesn't really feel like real, real. And I think like this felt a lot more approachable in a way that made it just like fun to play without ever feeling like, again, oh, it's work to, you know, read through or like play through this interaction. It feels, I think, naturalistic in a way that made it really entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, it also just kind of makes me think that, you know, obviously there have been, you know, centuries worth of books that have been written about a different time period that, you know, try to illustrate, you know, what people were like in any given time. But I think something I left Pentiment thinking about was like, video games is actually a really good medium for this kind of storytelling, where you're just kind of giving a pastiche almost of like what a time period was like. And then obviously there is a grand story in a sense in Pentiment with like the murder, but I think that this kind of interactive narrative almost lends itself a little bit better to illustrating that point than like a novel could, because of like, you're not going to get all the information. Like, you know, obviously you have a curated story, but like there's things you can miss. And like, you know, to Josh's point about, nobody who finishes Pentiment necessarily has the same conclusions about who should die and how that not only has to do with the different, you know, information that you glean through your playthrough, but also like your own perspectives and worldviews about like, well, I just don't like this person. Like, I feel like they shouldn't live, so I'm going to choose them, as opposed to like it being the right choice or like the right person to, you know, tie a bow on the narrative. I think that's a lot harder to do in like a novel, for instance, or a film.
Yep.
And yeah, I think that's like a really good argument for, not that we need to argue for it anymore, but like for these interactive narratives as like being a really valid way of showing these things.
I'm going to give a brief shout out to my buddy Joey, who I played with. He was kind of playing through Pentiment at the same time that I was playing through it. And we got into like a huge, like almost fight about like the choices that we were making. Because I think Joey was... I don't want to misrepresent his argument, but he was like, you know, we have to try to figure out like who is the actual right person, like who are the right choices to make here, who is like the person who is most likely to have committed the murder. And I was like, well, I just really don't like the brothers working at this abbey, you know, that it kind of sets you up that it'll let you, you know, choose them as the people, and so ultimately they're going to get murdered. So I was like, I, you know, this one guy, like, kind of an asshole, so I'm choosing him. And he's like, you can't make that, that's not the choice that you should be making, you should be trying to figure out like who actually did it. And I was like, I don't think that there is, like, there's no definitive proof one way or the other, and so I'm just going to go with like who do I dislike the most. And so I think, like, to your point, this thing starts happening that where it ends up revealing so much more about you as a person, and like what are your politics and what are the things that you care about, versus, you know, a novel where it's like you're just trying to glean like what is the main character, what is the protagonist's politics, what is the way that they're moving through the world, and what does that tell us. Instead, it's like becomes this very like, I think, fun mirror exercise where you're like, oh no, it's revealing horrible, terrible things about, you know, the choices that I make about how I move through the world.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what, you know, that's why games are so awesome, right? Like that player agency aspect of them allows you to, you know, have, you know, the narrative that's been curated for you in terms of, like, Pentiment, but then also, like, have this meta narrative of, like, how you have, you know, gotten to the end of the game and how that has influenced, like, your different you know, choices and, like, the different stories that you are then going to tell other people about, whether it be, like, Joey, who also played the game, or, like, somebody who maybe hasn't played the game. And you know, I think that's when games really shine. Like, not to derail us too much, because we could talk about this on, like, a study hall, but, like, that's why I think, like, Tears of the Kingdom is so interesting, or, like, even Breath of the Wild, like, because it's so free in terms of how you can navigate approaching the story. It allows you to, like, yes, you're going to get that story that they've made, but then you're also going to get all these other stories that only you can have because of, like, how you have, you know, played through the game. And that's, I think, where, you know, video game narratives really kind of argue for their place alongside, you know, all these other, like, literary or cinematic kind of stories. So yeah, Pentiment is really, really cool in that sense.
Counterpoint, when I see that someone has built a functioning mech and the only way that I've been getting through every puzzle is building what amounts to logs tied together so that I can get to a new area, it does make me feel very fucking stupid.
You know, Breath of the Wild will make you feel amazing, and then it'll also make you feel like an idiot, all within the span of 30 minutes. So, I mean, I definitely, as we talked about in the Resident Evil episode, I am a player who is going to just, like, figure out what the cheapest way is to
cheapest
to get
easiest
through.
Way to get through.
Yeah.
I'm going to make us, just for 2 seconds, talk about like, Pentiment and history, because I think, like, the thing that really, really, really made me fall in love with this game is its perspective on history is, like, unknowable to some extent, that, like, the things that we get, the artifacts that we have of the past that are carried forward, and you heard Josh kind of talking about it, it's like, oh, what gets written down is just, like, a tiny, tiny amount of, like, all the things that make up a moment in history and a moment in someone's life. And so, like, our understanding of the past is always going to be incomplete. And I just really, really love that. And I think, like, I love the way the thing that the game is saying about legacy, which is that, like, there's not really legacy. Like, after a certain point, you will be forgotten. Your era will be forgotten. At some point, this is all just going to get paved over and buried and disappear. And I just am so horny for that. I think, you know, we live in an age or an era where, like, we are just hyper fixated on, like, well, what's going to last and what are the things that are going to carry on forever. And so I don't know, when I think this game just, like, hit me at the right time, where I was like, yeah, well, like, why do I worry so much about legacy? Like, nobody's going to remember who I am. And that's, like, nice in a way. That's, like, freeing in a way, of not having to, like, always focus on, well, what sticks around and, like, what is going to last. I don't know. I walked away from this, like, really touched. Like, even the, you know, I think, like, the normal move, and again, we talked with Sam Barlow on, God, what was that game? Immortality, which is pretty explicitly making the argument that, like, well, art at least is permanent and fixed and carries forward, and can, like, infect people in a way that, like, that, you know, art stays with us. But this game explicitly is like, well, yeah, even art is, like, is imperfect as a way of, like, cataloging the past, but also that too is, like, not going to stick around. There's, like, a really beautiful moment at the end of Pentiment. This is minor spoilers for you and for anyone who's listening, jump to, like, I don't know, like, a minute from now, if you care. But, like, the final shot of it is there's a windmill, and, like, Andreas is, like, showing some kids, like, how to draw. And the spoke of the windmill just, like, keeps passing over, and they disappear, and the art's still there, and then it passes over again, and then the art is gone, and you're like, oh shit, because it's like it's all going away, and I just really, really was, like, moved by that. I think as a theme, and just as, like, as an exploration of, like, what does it mean, what are we doing with our time here, where is it all going. It was nice. That's all I have to say. Goodbye.
No, I mean, I 100% agree with you. And before I, like, go further into that, listeners, you should check out, you know, Ben's future story in Unwinnable called The Future Will Forget Us season and Pentiment on how art fails to capture one our complicated present. You know, I think Ben does a really good job of kind of connecting, you know, season, which came out like late last year, and Pentiment, and kind of how they're both engaged in, you know, histories and the histories we create, the things that we leave behind, and how, like you're just saying, like those are flawed, right? And I think, yeah, I mean, Pentiment starts out with like one of the early conversations, right? Is with was it Pietro or Piero or
Piero? I think, yeah.
Talking about, like, to Andreas about his masterpiece and how, you know, history is, you know, created by us who, you know, are like fallible beings, and it's all choices, you know. It's never complete. And while obviously I know that, I think, like, for some reason it is very when that comes up in the game, it is very, it kind of takes you back a little bit, because yeah, it is this kind of like, a lot of the time history is this thing that one person thought was you know, interesting enough to record in their very personal one and only lens. Yeah. And then, you know, after they've passed, or even maybe when they're alive, you know, society kind of cherry picks which are the most valuable things to construct the, you know, the patchwork that is, like, our collective history, right? And I think, yeah, this game really, I think it really speaks to that in a really interesting way, and uses, like, the visual element and the interactive element to showcase that in ways that are really affecting. Yeah, like, I don't think I would have, if let's say that Pentiment was a book, I don't think I would have had the same reaction even to, like, the parts that I played if I had just read it. You know, like, there is, like, an element to that interactive, that visual element that really heightens an already incredible kind of narrative that's happening on the page.
Yeah, no, 100%. The art adds a lot to it. Being able to, like, again, you select murals, you're, like, making choices, which I think gives you more buy-in, but then you're also, like, you are physically seeing, you know, all of this play out in front of you. And I think, yeah, there's just something about this form that I can't quite put my fingers on, but, like, the reading and the visuals and the sound and the choice all mixing together really, really works for me. And I just, like, find it very moving. And I think that's why I keep coming back to these types of game that fall into these, you know, this bucket.
Yeah. I mean, even, yeah, the whole kind of part of the conversation about, like, this will be remembered, and talking about how they kind of came to the different dialogue choices, and how, you know, not that Pentiment has created, you know, the style of dialogue choice gameplay, but just, like, making each choice not feel like it's a binary, like, oh, here's the good choice, here's the bad choice, and this is all going to coalesce into, like, the good ending, the bad ending, or whatever at the end. It kind of seems like the choices of dialogue also speak to what you're getting out of, like, this kind of nuanced, hard to square sense that you get from not only, like, the characters you meet, but also, like, this whole idea around history and art and what we choose to remember. So yeah, this was just a really cool conversation, and Josh was just, like, a really, really nice and generous dude. So, like, I had a lot of fun with this one.
Am I Josh Sawyer-pilled? Am I going to go play New Vegas after this? I think so. Also, we didn't even bring up any of the Pillars games with him. But yeah, it was funny because I had not clocked until too late. I was like, oh, he's also Pillars 1 and 2. Great games.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that just means we're going to have him back, you know?
Come back and talk Deadfire with me. Let's go.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was our conversation with Josh Sawyer about Pentiment. Yeah, again, just really glad that he was able to come on and talk a little bit further about a really, really unique game, and one that I think it's easy for some people to overlook or not think is for them. So, you know, if you're interested in Pentiment, you know, I believe it's on Steam, or you can, you know, get it for free if you have Game Pass and Xbox. Definitely worth your time.
Game Pass, it's what I did. I got a Xbox controller and played it on my Mac.
Exactly. So with that, we will catch y'all here on the next episode of Origin Story. And with that, we'll see you later.
Bye.
Thanks again for checking out the show. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, it is 3DCisco on Twitter, as well as Instagram. And you can follow Ben on Twitter at sad_radio_lad. We wanted to thank Melody Hirsch, who designed all the awesome cover art and design work for the website and the podcast itself. And we wanted to thank Ryan Hopper, who does all the intro and outro music, as well as some of the interstitial stuff you hear in different episodes. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a review on iTunes, you know, subscribed on either iTunes or Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts. You know, reviews help just get the show in front of more people. And it only takes a couple of minutes. So yeah, if you could do that for us, it'd be greatly appreciated.
You should also visit our website at www.originstory.show. It's a great place to look at all of our episodes. There are full transcripts and a link to our Discord channel where we talk with listeners about everything OS and beyond. There's a lot of posting that goes on in there. So I don't know. If you're into that, come join us. You can also email us at theoriginstorypod@gmail.com. We're always looking for feedback, whether it's ideas for, you know, games that we should play, books we should read, guests that we should have on the show. Just hit us up with thoughts, feelings. We're always looking for feedback, even if it's that Ben has an annoying voice and you don't want to hear it anymore. I mean, that's totally fine. So write us in. You can also follow us on Twitter at @OriginStory_ or our Instagram at OriginStory.show. As always, thanks for listening.